And welcome back to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer here today for Mina Kim. And for the rest of this hour, we're talking about California's death penalty. Last month, voters rejected Proposition 62. That measure would have banned capital punishment, instead narrowly approving Prop 66. It promises to put California's death penalty on a faster track by shortening the time for legal appeals, which now drag on for decades. The state is also close to giving final approval to a new single-drug execution protocol, but lawsuits are already challenging all of that. And here now to talk about where we stand with capital punishment are Anne-Marie Schubert. She's the district attorney for Sacramento County and a big proponent of Prop 66. And Anne-Marie Schubert, good to have you with us this morning.
Thank you very much, Scott.
And with me here in the studio is Hadar Aviram. She's professor at UC Hastings College of the Law and author of Cheap on Crime, Recession-Era Politics, and the Transformation of American Punishment. Good to have you here as well.
Thank you. Good morning.
Let me begin with you, D.A. Schubert. Prop 66 has now passed. What happens next?
Well, what happens next is that we implement the will of California voters and we fix the death penalty as we promised several years ago when Prop 34 was rejected. So we're going to do everything we can to make sure that we fulfill the promise, implement what that initiative calls for, and ultimately carry out the sentences that juries across California have recommended.
But nonetheless, there is still a federal hold on executions because of what was the three-drug protocol. That was put in place in 2006. There is now, as I mentioned, this new protocol that is about to be given final approval by the state. But that's not the end of the story, is it?
No, that's not the end of the story, because the initiative clearly established that the execution protocols are exempt from the Administrative Procedures Act. So it's our position that we are, that protocol has been developed and that now it's time for us to move forward and implement those sentences.
And Professor Aviram, there is litigation aimed at that new protocol, correct?
Indeed. There are two lawsuits pending, one against Prop 66 for a variety of reasons that I hope we'll touch on, and the other one against the state law that makes it the business of the administration to deal with the protocols rather than the California legislature.
And what's wrong with that?
Well, part of the problem is that when things get decided by correctional officers themselves, they get decided for a variety of internal reasons rather than let the public really weigh in on what it means. I think that if the public knew more about the mechanisms of the death penalty, they would probably have been less excited about supporting 66.
Well, but aren't you underestimating voters? I mean, they presumably took a look at both. There was also extensive public comment period on the new protocol. I mean, there were hundreds of pages of comments.
Part of what is difficult about understanding the meaning of this is that when we have to decide what counts or doesn't count as cruel or unusual punishment, we're making judgments about things that we ourselves have no experience with and we have not felt ourselves. So in deciding between complicated chemicals, which of these causes more suffering than the other, that is not really something that we can trust correctional officers to just make a call on. This is something that requires careful thinking by people who understand the medical meanings of this, the moral meanings of this, and not something that should be just done by administrators on the fly.
Anne-Marie Schubert, I've heard from some proponents of Prop 66 that we could have an execution in California within a matter of months. Do you agree with that?
Well, there's 19 people, as far as I know, that have exhausted all appeals and have sat there for decades waiting for their sentence to be imposed. So, you know, now it's a matter of moving forward with those executions. I think it's quite possible if we are true to what Prop 66 requires, that those sentences should be carried out.
So those 19 death row inmates would be presumably the first to get execution dates?
Well, they've exhausted appeals, so yes, they have to finish their appeals process before a warrant can be issued for that sentence to be imposed.
And Governor Brown, of course, opposes capital punishment. Presumably, he voted against Prop 66, although he hasn't said. To what extent can he, by himself, slow things down to ensure that there isn't an execution on his watch?
Well, I mean, that's a difficult question to answer. I mean, you know, at this point, the executions should be carried out, and they, you know, would essentially get back to the trial court for an issuance of what they call a death warrant. But, you know, I suppose that the governor could ultimately try to commute people off of death row like previous history has done. But, you know, time and time again, Californians have said that they support this policy. And obviously that's our goal, is that we carry out the will of the people.
One of the ways that these appeals presumably will be shortened is not only a time limit, but also requiring more lawyers who handle non-capital appeals right now to also handle these death penalty appeals. And D.A. Shewhart, how is that going to happen? I mean, you have to train people to do that, right? You can't just say, here, take this case.
Well, of course. I mean, there's nobody here that is advocating that we hire unqualified lawyers. The initiative very much clearly states that we are, asking for that attorneys who are qualified for the appointment of those cases, that they have to meet the qualifications for capital appeals. Now, the opponents of this who don't want these sentences carried out keep saying that, the sky is falling, we'll never find enough lawyers. And I think that's, quite frankly, lacks merit.
If you were on death row, would you rather have an experienced appeals attorney or one who just got trained?
Well, I mean, they're going to be trained, but they're not going to be allowed to be appointed unless they're qualified to handle that appeal. And the reality is that we've already gotten to the point through a trial where somebody has represented them. In fact, two lawyers have represented that individual. They are qualified. They have gone through the process. The jury has made a finding. Do we want unqualified lawyers for the appellate process? Of course not. But we're not going to appoint unqualified lawyers.
And Professor Avaram, what are the challenges to training attorneys and bringing them up to speed?
Well, this is where I have to disagree with Ms. Shewart. I think it's fairly unrealistic to expect people who come into a highly specialized and difficult field of law to be able to provide people with the kind of careful representation that we require when we're talking about outcomes that are irreversible. And I think that one of the things that we would have to do is we would have to realize, and I'm sure we will in short time, that with regard to the death penalty, the blanket is just too short. You can't have it always. You can't have a system that's parsimonious and that doesn't cost an enormous amount of money, and have people who are professional and who can provide representation and make those cases run swiftly. This is just not something that is possible within the resources that the state has. And this is partly what the lawsuit is arguing. There's no way to qualify these people after decades that we've had a very, very small pool of attorneys when we have hundreds of people on death row who are unrepresented. I should probably mention the average time at this point before you get represented on death row, on appeal or on habeas, is 16 years. This is partly why we have these lengthy delays. It's unrealistic to think that we're going to be able to plug that hole by infusing huge amounts of money into the system and train people to do litigation that's extremely technically complicated and sophisticated in a brief period of time.
And Anne-Marie Shewart, what's wrong with that analysis?
What's wrong with that analysis is the very people that are deciding who's been appointed in the past are the people that don't want these sentences imposed. So the pool of lawyers is small because the people that don't want the death penalty have limited the number of lawyers that can be qualified on those cases. And so, for instance, if you had been a prosecutor 25 years ago doing these types of cases, they wouldn't let you be on that panel. And I realize that the professor wants to make these cases look like that nobody can handle them, that quite frankly, there's a large pool of attorneys out there in the state of California that are qualified. We've got people that are qualified to handle life without the possibility of parole. And I'm quite confident that many of those folks are very capable of handling these types of appeals. I don't want to oversimplify the types of cases that we're talking about or underestimate the magnitude of the cases. But the reality is many of these issues for appeal are issues that have been litigated time and time again. They are not something that are so extreme that, only a very few number can actually handle.
But can you really force somebody? You can't force, say, a surgeon to operate on a particular person. Can you force an attorney to take up a particular case? Or kind of case?
Well, no, what we're telling them is that if they want to handle cases and be paid by the state of California to handle appeals, that they have to be willing to handle all types of appeals. Time is going to tell what the pool of lawyers looks like.
We're talking about the passage of Prop 66, which is theoretically going to speed up executions in California. Voters also rejected Prop 62 to ban capital punishment. And if you'd like to join this conversation, give us a ring at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can also email your comments to forum@kqed.org or tweet them to us. It's at KQED Forum, or leave a message on our Facebook page as well. Professor Avaram, what do you think, why shouldn't victims of crime who have been waiting in many cases so long for executions? I mean, You know, we've had over 900 or almost 900 death sentences handed down. We've had 13 executions. Isn't that unfair to those families?
So first of all, Scott, I think we should be very wary about thinking about victims as a monolith. There are many different people and they respond to these tragedies in very different ways. There was a considerable number of victim families who supported 62 and opposed 66, partly because they thought that the cost, the uncertainty and all the things that were involved in California death penalty are just not worth it to them. So we can't speak about victims as a monolith. There's also a question about whether the expense and the effort that we spend on these cases, and I say this with an enormous amount of sympathy for people who have been victimized by homicide, we have to ask ourselves, is revenge really the only consideration that has to come in here? Shouldn't we also think about prudent spending? Shouldn't we also think about the concern of executing innocent people, which incidentally will victimize more families?
Although that's never happened in California.
That is not true. I've campaigned for 466 with at least one person who did time in San Quentin for a murder he didn't commit.
Okay, well, you said executions. There's no one's been innocent. No executions of someone who's innocent.
To the extent that we know. I don't know that we can know this for certain when we're talking about an irreversible punishment.
And D.A. Schubert, how are victims of crime and their families, I mean, there's an expectation now with Prop 66 passing that they're going to get the justice that they want, at least those of whom supported Prop 66. To what extent is there a risk here that it's a false promise to them?
Well, you can't start with a promise unless you're willing to deliver on it. So back in 2012, as I mentioned, when California, you know, agreed again that the death penalty was an appropriate sentence, we made a promise at that time. And so now we're here to deliver on that promise to fix it. So we're not going to give up on this and just say, you know, they're going to file a couple lawsuits again to try to stop these executions. We're going to continue on. You know, and with all due respect to the professor, you know, she says this is about revenge. This is not about revenge. This is about justice that juries have made decisions on. And I think it's, you know, we can never forget. I don't stand in the shoes of victims. You're always going to probably be able to find some folks that stand on both sides of the aisle. But at the end of the day, the sentences are driven by the facts of these crimes. And no one ever wants to talk about the facts because they realize that there's a reason why these individuals earn those sentences.
All right, let's go to the phones now. Professor, do you want to say something real quick?
Yes, it's just the concept of justice doesn't necessarily require an eye for an eye. There are many countries, in fact, all of the Western world, that conceives of justice differently than D.A. Schubert and believe that life without parole is a sufficient delivery of justice, even on heinous facts.
All right, 866-733-6786 is the number to call if you want to join this conversation. We'll begin in Oakland with Mike. Welcome.
Hi. My question is, where is the money going to come from to pay for habeas attorneys? Because if you look at Los Angeles County alone, there's more than 100 defendants right now waiting for habeas attorneys to be appointed. At current pay rates, that's going to cost around $32 million. That's just in L.A. And the proposition didn't set up a funding source, and the budgets for the courts have already been slashed to the bone. So who's going to pay for all this?
Amory Schubert, let me put that to you, and just explain what a habeas attorney is.
A habeas attorney is an attorney that's hired to do a collateral attack. So once the case has been appealed through the direct appeal process, then you do yet another appeal. And so that's for the habeas petitions. So, you know, the funding is, it's in a way, it's no different than Prop 57, which is this wholesale, you know, release of inmates that provided no funding for rehabilitation. So
I think the governor might not describe it that way. He supported it, but.
No, I understand that. I'm talking more about the funding of it. So, you know, Prop 57 didn't call for funding of rehabilitation, which is what we all want people to have. But under this particular initiative, Prop 66, yeah, we already have a habeas process. They have a right to a habeas lawyer. So we do pay for that. So we're going to have to continue to fund that. And when we go back to the professor's comment, is it just cost too much? Well, you know, these are the most serious cases. And just because if we got rid of the death penalty, doesn't mean they're not going to file habeas. It doesn't mean they're going to stop their appeals. It costs money to have a criminal justice system, and these are obviously going to be the most expensive because they are most serious types of crimes.
Professor Avron?
Okay, there's a couple of things here that I just need to correct factually. One of them is the fact that the money for any habeas processes that are filed by lifers would not come from the same pool because California only provides free representation to death row inmates, not to lifers. But more to the point, Mike, I completely agree with you. This is an unconscionable expense. Part of the reason why I'm sort of sitting here a little bit incredulous is that the comparison between 57 and 66 is laughable. 57 might mean that we're going to release nonviolent inmates, therefore saving us us money in the long run rather than spending money. Rehabilitation is something that doesn't cost nearly as much as the $150 million a year that we spend on the death penalty in the state.
Although there is some debate about that cost, and the LAO, the legislative analyst, said that there could be short-term costs, but then it could save money down the road.
There could be, but it's not going to be anywhere near what we currently spend on the death penalty and all the additional costs we're going to have by trying to implement this new proposition.
All right, Mike, thanks very much for the call. Let's go to now Kent in Sacramento. Good morning.
Good morning. I would like to ask Professor Avram what the basis for her assertion is that the Department of Corrections developed this protocol on the fly and just by correctional officers without consulting with experts. I don't believe that is true.
I guess the question I would ask back to you, Kent, is who exactly is an expert on what is moral and on what suffering means and on what kind of suffering the state is willing to countenance in essentially doing state-sponsored executions? And that is something that doesn't just depend on technical opinions about which chemicals are cheaper or what is more efficient. You don't really know, and none of us really can know, what cruel and unusual punishment means in terms of using these chemicals. This is a decision that needs to be made with input from medical, from moral, from ethical thinkers, from all sides of this question. And it's an issue that elected officials, with input from the public and with input from various constituencies, need to make.
And Kent, I should just, sounds like Kent Scheidegger from the Criminal Justice Foundation in Sacramento. Is that correct?
What's that?
Is this Kent Scheidegger from the?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, hi. Now, I know you were actually party to the lawsuit kind of forcing, that ended up forcing the Brown administration to finally, or the CDCR, to come up with some new protocol.
Yes, it is. And they developed it over a period of many months, very carefully, with consultation with medical experts as far as what these drugs do and whether they cause pain or not. As far as the moral question, that's for the people to decide.
But just on those drugs, I mean, the new protocol, I think, suggests using one of four different drugs, two of which have never been used in executions, and the other two, I believe, the manufacturer doesn't want them used for executions.
Well,
isn't that a problem,
course,
with the new protocol?
Yeah. Of course, every drug that's used for executions has to be used a first time sometime. So I don't think that's a valid objection. They are drugs that have been used for many years in medical purposes, and we know what the effects are.
Professor?
I guess to that I would ask any of our listeners, would you want you or a family member to be the first person to try the new drug? And here's the thing about the drugs. We've had for years three drug protocols all around the country, and we've had to reform them partly because we're light years behind the Western world with respect to the death penalty, and manufacturers of these drugs will no longer sell them to the United States because of what we use them for.
What would you say, though, to crime victims who say, you know, I'm sorry if they're, go through a little bit of pain, but these folks didn't ask my daughter or my wife or my husband or my whoever it might be that they killed whether they were suffering any pain. I mean, why should we have that much compassion for folks who committed some of the most heinous crimes you can imagine?
Well, the first thing I would say to victims, and the second and the third, is how sorry I am for their horrific loss, which, of course, is always true. And I know that many of these people have been victims of heinous and cruel crimes. I don't think anybody's trying to whitewash or hide those facts. But I would also say that while their opinion is important, it is not the only thing that needs to bear on this subject. And there are other considerations of ethics and morality beyond what certain victims want.
All right. Kent, before I let you go, any final comment?
Well, I just wanted to reiterate that medical experts were consulted, and these drugs are determined to be very low risk of causing any serious pain.
All right, Kent, thanks very much for the call. Let's go now to Chris in San Jose. Welcome.
Oh, yes. Hi. I just had a question for the professor, that prosecutors use the threat of death penalty against the defendants and can try to get guilty pleas a little faster and get the cases cleared faster. So isn't that maybe a useful tool that prosecutors have that may be taken away if you take away the death penalty?
Professor Avram?
So this is a serious consideration, and this is something that, having lost a friend to a heinous murder a few years ago, I've been pondering about. That incident was in Florida, where they have been trying to use the death penalty to get people to agree to plea deals and provide more information. In some cases, it's effective, and in some cases, it isn't. And in I mean, the entirety of the Western world works without the death penalty, and somehow they manage to convict people. Somehow they manage to investigate things. Somehow they manage to get people to agree to plea bargains to the extent that they're used elsewhere in the world without using the threat of the death penalty. We know from decades of research that the death penalty does not deter crime. People do not give thought to whether their state has the death penalty or not when they decide whether to commit murders. Having the death penalty in place does not reduce the number of murders. There's no causal link between them. So I don't know that we can really count on the threat of the death penalty without being willing to back it up. And if we are willing to back it up, then we have a lot more serious moral problems to contend with.
Henry Schubert, I know, as you know, the number of death sentences handed down has been falling over the past few years. That said, they also are disproportionately handed down in certain counties in California, like Riverside, San Bernardino, Kern County, Fresno, perhaps. But you're not going to have a death sentence handed down in San Francisco, very unlikely in Marin, and so on. Does that geographic, you know, disparity, does it bother you at all?
Well, I mean, you can look at other states. We don't have the death penalty in other states, and so you can make an argument that there's a disparate treatment from, you know, one state to California. You know, I'm an elected official. I'm elected by the voters of Sacramento. I am going to fulfill my duty to the voters and the citizens of Sacramento County. What I know from my perspective here as the elected DA is that it's a rare event. It's always going to be a rare event. I think in the time that I've been the DA for less than 2 years, we've only made a decision on two cases out of well over 100-something cases. And so I look at it from my perspective. I'm not going to speak about Riverside or other counties and how they go through their vetting process. But what I can say is, you know, whatever county it is, it remains a rare event. It always should remain a rare event.
And Professor Avaron, what would you add to that?
I wish this were true. In L.A. County, for example, more people are sentenced to death than in the entire state of Texas, which is pretty astonishing, but is true.
I should have mentioned L.A. Of course, they have by far the most, although maybe not per capita.
So, of course, this
in California.
Of course, we are different than other states that don't have the death penalty. But the death penalty is a state law. It's not a national law, which means that when we're looking for discrimination, we're looking within the states.
But counties always implement things. Look at marijuana, for example. I mean, those laws are implemented differently. There is some element of local control, isn't there?
But there is going to be, after Prop 64 passed, you know, a certain amount of state, a certain minimum that the state requires of all counties. And I think that if anything, something as serious as this should be something where there's more uniformity. I think it's extremely problematic to send one person to an irreversible and cruel and unusual punishment because they happen to commit the same offense in a different county than somebody else who'd end up with life without parole.
Dia Schubert, quick comment, and I'm going to go to some other comments from my listeners.
Well, it's obvious to me, and I respect the professor's, you know, own moral opinion, but she's obviously highly opposed to the death penalty in any form or substance. And so that's, you know, we have to come from that perspective. But we're here from the perspective of the voters have rejected 62, have approved 66, and now and it's the same with 57. I may have opposed it, but I'm going to stand with everybody to make sure it works to the best of our ability. So we have an obligation now to carry out the will of the people.
All right, let me read some comments here. Nick writes on Facebook, I think that the ballot was purposefully structured to confuse voters. If it had been more clear and simple, I doubt voters would have chosen this outcome. I'm not quite sure what he's referring to. Rick writes, California citizens have voted for the death penalty over and over again, and lawmakers plus attorneys have defied the need to rid our society of these most ruthless offenders. Most delays have been red herrings, such as the drug programs. How can a drug to kill a super violent murderer be difficult to find? And when many states have drugs designed to allow terminally ill patients to check out with comfort. Professor?
So these are valuable comments. I want to take them each in turn. The first one has to do with the initiative process in general. And one of the things to remember about California, and this is one of the things that makes California unique vis-a-vis other states, is that California is a very neo-populist state, which means that we've always run things by referendum and that it's very difficult to run things here through the legislature, which means that a lot of complicated things that have a lot of corners and alleyways that really should be the subject of careful legislation end up being reduced to yes-no questions that are presented to the public. Incidentally, one of the things that I said before the election is that Prop 62 is one of the only examples I could think of something that is simple enough to be reduced to a referendum question of yes and no. Prop 66 certainly is not. I very much doubt that the people who voted for Prop 66 were fully aware of the implications of Prop 66.
Well, you could say that about Prop 64, the marijuana law,
absolutely,
too, and gun control, I mean, anything.
Absolutely.
That's the system we have.
There are many propositions that really shouldn't be propositions. There are many things that we legislate via referendum that shouldn't be legislated via referendum, because that's just not the way it works. As to the second comment, and this is related to the first comment, one of the things to keep in mind about the abolition of the death penalty elsewhere in the world is that abolition that comes top down frequently precedes public opinion. In France, for example, when the death penalty was abolished, there was still a majority of people in France who supported it. The support gradually receded after the death penalty was abolished.
All right, I want to bring it back to California. And Anne-Marie Schubert, what are your concerns going forward now? One we talked about earlier, which is that there is no funding mechanism in this proposition to fund these attorneys to be trained to expedite the process. How are you going to hold, say, the legislature and the governor accountable? Not you personally, but how is that going to happen?
The initiative. It very clearly states that they have to hire attorneys to represent individuals. There's timelines that are going to be set. There's rules that need to be adopted within the next 18 months. You know, my concern, it's a concern, but it's something that we're going to continue fighting for, is that, you know, the very people that don't want the death penalty, of course, they're going to file lawsuits to stop again. Once again, the will of the people. And we're going to fight those lawsuits. We're confident that we're going to win those lawsuits, and we're going to move forward, and we're going to carry out the judgments that juries across California have continuously imposed.
Here's a tweet from Dylan who writes, what about the disproportionate impact on people of color? Can we justify it given our country's history of slavery, genocide, and so on? Dia Schubert, does that concern you at all?
Well, I know from our perspective, we don't make decisions based upon somebody's race or ethnic origin or anything like that. We make decisions based upon the facts of the crime. If you look at the population of those individuals on death row, I haven't looked at it in the last couple of months, but my recollection is that it's fairly evenly split.
Yeah, but the population it's about a third Latino, a third African American, a third white, but
right,
obviously the population
right.
is quite different from that.
I think that argument has come up many times. You can make the same argument. What about the victims that are victims of color? Do we choose not to seek the death penalty against a particular individual? How do we justify that? Again, the justification for the seeking of any death penalty should be based upon the facts and circumstances of the crime in the individual in that person's background.
Just about 30 seconds left, Professor. What are you going to be looking for and expecting in terms of litigation in the coming months?
Well, I think that the ACLU lawsuit against Prop 66 has fairly good chances of succeeding. I'll be very enthusiastic to look at it. Just a short point about racial discrimination. One of the things about implicit bias is that it is implicit, and even people who have the best intentions to apply the law equally, when we look at the numbers, end up not doing that, and this is one of my most serious concerns.
All right. Well, I'm sure this is not the last conversation we're going to have about the death penalty in California, but thanks to both of our guests, Hadar Avaram, professor from UC Hastings College of the Law, author of Cheap on Crime, Recession-Era Politics and the Transformation of American Punishment, and Anne-Marie Schubert, district attorney up in Sacramento County. Thanks to you. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineers are Katie McMurrin and Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, and we get online support from Amanda Font. Our interns are Brandon Yu and Maxine Schofer-Wolf. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our executive producer is Joanne Wallace. For Mina Kim, get better. And from all of us here at KQED, I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Good weekend.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.